Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
When you need to do more with less, Upwork helps you hire fast without the overhead. Find expert freelancers in design, marketing, IT, AI, and more. Never tried Upwork? Now's the perfect time. Spend your first $1,000 and get $200 in credit for your next project. No upfront costs. No long-term commitments. Just $200 to reinvest in what matters. Go to Upwork.com/save to get started. That's UPWORK.com/SAVE. Upwork.com/save.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to F1 Explains. I'm Christian Hugill. This is what happens on this podcast. You send your questions to F1explains@F1.com, and we find the best people to answer them. This is one of our quick fire specials where we put some of those questions on all sorts of F1 based subjects to two expert guests. Now, Formula One has seen some iconic double acts over the years. Prost and Senna, Lewis and Bono, Lauda and Hunt, the FIA, and a contempt for swearing. But we have a broadcasting double act for the ages here. Think Anton Deck, think Regis and Kelly, think Richard and Judy. Between them, they have one GP2 championship, 9 Formula One World Championship points, and 1 Sports Commentator of the Year award.
Yeah.
I'll let you work out who won that. It is Jolyon Palmer and Alex Jakes. Welcome to F1 Explains, gentlemen.
Thank you, Christian. We've never had such a good build-up, have
That's
we?
That's one of the great intros.
Well, thank you.
Very, very good. I enjoyed that a lot.
Well, I appreciate you. We try. We've done this ages ago, a commentary box quickfire back in the first season of this, but it's great to do it again. Now, we're recording. We've gone back in time this week. The F1 circus has moved on, but we recorded this in Monaco. We're sat at a very nice location with the boats behind us, but there is a lot of cars on track at the moment, so it's a bit noisy. But listen, it's podcasting. We'll make the best of it. We don't mind a bit of noise, do we?
Well, it is a motor racing circuit, Christian, so that does tend to crop up from time to time.
It does, and there's very little consideration for recording our podcasts at these motor racing venues.
I mean, that's
venues.
A priority, isn't it? At the Monaco Grand Prix.
Damn well should be.
Yeah,
damn
okay.
Well should be. We will begin with a question about broadcasting, in a way. This is one of our voice notes.
Hi, I'm Lily from California. I'm curious what commentators see during the race. Do they see what we see on broadcast, or is there more information for them to pull from? Also, do they have a part in what graphics or radios get aired, or what is going on with the steward decisions before we do? How do they decide who speaks on what subjects? Thanks.
Well, we do have a screen. Our main broadcast screen is what everyone sees at home. But I'm relieved to say that we also get quite a lot of information. We have timing pages. So you have a traditional, like, timing page 1 is the old school order. That page hasn't changed since the mid-90s. And then Palmer likes a slightly different timing page. I like a slightly different timing page.
So
it's different. It's different from each side of the box. To answer Millie's specific question, we do get the messages from race control about 30 seconds to a minute before they're graphiced up on screen. So we'll sometimes refer to them a couple of times. We have a driver tracker, which is very, very useful as well. But as for do we have any influence on what is played out, I wish. Because I would go, frankly, mad with power. It wouldn't be very good, but I would enjoy the power. So, Team Raiders, everyone, no matter where you watch Formula One around the world, you're seeing the same feed, no matter which channel, no matter which country.
Jolyon, was this a lot to get used to when you became a broadcaster? Because you're very, very good at it. And people like you actively annoy me, who are very good racing drivers, then become very good broadcasters. I'm not even a very good broadcaster, let alone a racing driver. So, Jolyon, did you have to sort of get used to all of this? Because there's a lot of tech.
Not really. So basically, when I was stopped racing, went into broadcast, I was on radio with 5 Live. And you're basically just there with a microphone, watching the telly, saying what you see. And now you know, we have got more timing screens, but as a driver, you're used to seeing all the timing screens anyway. So even when you're in the garage, the TV screens come down and you're looking at many sectors, you're looking at things that everyone's doing. So it's basically just what I've been doing for years, like watching F1 on the telly. Yeah, I can do that. Watching with timing screens. Yeah, I can do that. Okay, now just have a microphone in your hand and talk about it. So it was kind of pretty natural.
The big difference, though, from when you were, say, in the Renault garage in your Formula One days was, I'm imagining, I don't know this for a fact, but I'm imagining Alex Jakes wasn't there. So how is that to get used to?
Well, I would say he does the hard graft of a commentary. So Jakes, he's giving it the big one, the start of the race. The key moments he's covering and I'm watching. And I think we just build up a natural. We know roughly when, I know when he's going to stop talking and he's expecting me to say something. Hopefully most of the time I have something to say, otherwise there's a long pause and then he'll pick up again. But
That has been known to happen.
Is that how you know, is that how you know he's got nothing to add? Yeah, he just doesn't say anything.
Yeah. Essentially, the easiest way to break it down is I'm roughly saying what's happening, Palmer's saying why it's happening, and using all of his expertise, and that's essentially, and you'll cross over occasionally, but that's essentially the breakdown of how a commentary works and who talks at what point.
It's particularly impressive, the sort of relationship these two have, considering, like a lot of TV or radio double acts, they actually hate each other.
Yeah.
Actually don't talk to each other.
We managed to keep a lid on that for most of the year.
It's outed now, isn't it?
A similar question is from Becky in Southampton in the UK. Becky says, F1 commentary is nothing like football or cricket or many other sports because the commentators can't possibly see everything all of the time. So how is it done? Who has ownership of the camera direction covering the races? How many cameras are there? How is this all channeled into broadcasters in the media? How do the commentators know what visual and audio feeds they're going to get? And how do they coordinate and adapt to whatever the audience can see or hear? Alex, it's a big question.
It's a long question. Okay, let's break that down. So how you cover not being able to see all of the action at the time is you've got the timing pages, you've got the driver tracker, which we rely on a lot in terms of you see a yellow flag, you're looking for the static dot. That's the reason for the yellow flag. So that's how we'll get that earlier. In terms of how things are decided around the circuit, there is at least 30 cameras. We've got a drone camera, we've got cameras in the curbs, we've got fixed cameras, we've also got some of the best camera ops in the world. That all gets plugged into a feed that is mixed on site, and then that's what's called the track mix. So just following the cars around the perimeter of the circuit, that's what's called the track mix. All the additional stuff like team radio, onboards, that is generated from a site, Biggin Hill Media and Technology Centre, that Formula One has, basically an amazing HQ.
Just outside London.
Quite a bit outside London. Anyway, that's another point for another day.
As the crow flies.
Exactly. Anyway, so the track mix is done on site. It is then beamed to F1 HQ. It is mixed by a director. And then you add in all the onboards, all the team radio, all the different camera angles, and that is the product that you see at home, and it's all done in real time across split sites. And in terms of what we commentate on, they cover almost everything, so we're not really missing too much. This man, one of the best race readers in the world, so not much gets past Palmer.
This might be a silly question, Jolyon. I mean, it's never stopped me in the past, but still, how do you become good at reading Grand Prix? Because not all ex-racing drivers are good at it, as I'm sure Alex Jakes has found over the years. How do you get good at sort of knowing everything that's going on? Because when you're a racing driver, you're focusing on your own race.
Yeah, so weirdly, my biggest blank spots in Formula One history, or is in my living history, are when I was racing. Because if you ask me about happened in 2016 or 2017, they're my worst years to try and recall what happened, because I was so focused on what I was doing. Apart from that, I've just been obviously watching as a fan when I was younger. And so my brain, when something's happening in the commentary box now, or nothing's happening, Jakes is talking, taking us through the leader that's just cruising away, second place is 5 seconds back. My brain goes, how is this race going to change? What might happen to mix this up? And then you're looking for pit stop gaps. You're looking for what happens if there's a safety car now? Looking down the order to see, is there another battle that we can pick up and that's got a bit of relevance? So I think it's just the way my brain naturally works during a race. If you're passive and you watch the pictures, I think you can be surprised when anything happens. Mm. But I'm looking at the pictures, but I'm also thinking, okay, what might spice up this race? And can we mention it before it happens, or can we be ready when it does happen, just in case? And a lot of the time, what I say or what I think doesn't come true, but occasionally, bang, there's your safety car, and right, here we go, this is gonna spice the race up.
And that's the beauty of it. Now, one of the many sessions you commentate on, guys, you'll commentate on the race, you'll sometimes commentate on free practice too, you'll also commentate on qualifying, and that's the questions that we've got next from Michael specifically. Michael says, with some cars on flying laps and others on out laps, how do the slower cars make sure they stay out the way of the faster ones? Do the race engineers let them know when faster cars are approaching so they can stay off the racing line? Jolyon, that to me, looking from the outside, this seems like a nightmare.
This is a nightmare. It's one of the It just gets ingrained into you as you're going, in qualifying particularly, especially Q1 when you've got all the cars out there, and especially, I mean, we're in Monaco where it's going to be critical, but there are various other circuits around, your Budapest, your tight twisty circuits where it is just difficult to get out of the way. So impeding obviously becomes such a big thing. You can have a great qualifying and then just end up sort of dozily impeding a Haas in Q1, and it comes back to bite an hour later, and you're docked three places on the grid. So it's just basically ingrained. Every time you're on a slow lap, you're thinking, get your tyres into the right window, especially if you're on an out lap. Work on all of that, but what's the gaps around you? And if you basically rely on your race engineer to come up with, these are the gaps, watch out, 8 seconds back you've got X, 15 seconds back you've got Y, and that'll just be fed to you the whole time. And then you know when it's a couple of seconds, you look in the mirror and there he is.
And we've just been talking, Alex, about you guys having to keep across everything that's going on during the race. I'm imagining that's where the job of a race engineer will change a little bit. On a race day, of course, they are keeping an eye across the whole field because the whole field could impact their driver, but they are more focused on their driver. In a qualifying session in particular, the race engineer needs to have a really good knowledge of what's going on across track, don't they? Because, as you say, you don't want to dozily impede a Haas.
Yeah, because it ruins your weekend if you get that wrong. Palmer's got a great story about race engineers not fully paying attention to what's happened on track.
Which was that?
Well, yeah, I like this one. You know when we had Lance Stroll last year crashing in Jeddah, and he was like, can you get back? And he's like, no, I'm in the wall.
You've had a
very similar thing, haven't you? Because the engineers are so plugged in.
Yeah, so I've got various race engineer stories. But the engineers, so it's actually a pretty hectic, it's a really hectic job. We hear them on the radio and they are like robots, but it's because they're taking a lot in, but they're not watching the telly. They're watching screens. They're watching a driver tracker to give the gaps. They're also looking at they've got Race Watch, so a software program that will give the gaps in a bit more detail to just the driver tracker. So when they release a car in qualifying, their first thing is, okay, make sure, you know, radio to the drivers, communication about your build lap, your gaps. But then they're just looking at data. So they are looking at the lines coming up, live telemetry that's buzzing off the car onto all the computer screens back in the office. So they'll see a spin. They'll see it goes haywire on the squiggly lines, but they don't know what's happened. So they'll get on the radio and be like, everything okay? And that's like the default radio message. And if you put the car into a million pieces, they haven't seen that yet. There's a red flag. There's a massive stoppage. And they don't know that actually you've just had a monumental crash. And they just see, oh, the car's stationary now. What's happened? Everyone else around can see exactly that. So when you're in the cockpit and you've just had a bit of a go, you're in the wall, you feel like a wally, and then your race engineer's, what's happened? Can you get it back? You're like, no, mate, no. Just watch the telly this time. It's not pretty.
There's no wheels on the car. Of course I can't get it
but
back.
But that makes so much sense, because then that little bit of radio is clipped up. It's played on the telly alongside an onboard camera of the driver in the wall. And that poor race engineer's going, everything okay? Well,
yeah.
No, we're going, clearly not, but they've not seen that.
And that's the process behind it. I always enjoy hearing that.
That's absolutely excellent. I'd never thought of that. Fantastic. And one more on qualifying. Dean in Victoria in Australia. Why during qualifying do the drivers do one quick lap, then one slow down lap? Why don't they do more fast laps in a row? Great question from Dean, isn't it, Jolyon?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, the basic thing is the tyres won't hang on for more than one lap. So the soft tyres that are pretty much always used in qualifying, they are good, sometimes not even for a total lap. You have to be a little bit gentle with them at the start of the lap, or they start to fall away at the end of the lap. These are the grippiest tyres, and they are literally one lap tyres, if you get it right. There are some circuits where they can do more than one lap and you see a cool lap and then another push lap. that even that is to try and get the temperatures back into the right window. But you've also got the battery. So the energy deployment from the battery, you want to give it the full beans on the first lap when the tyres theoretically should be in their best window. And then you need to recharge the battery as well. So if you see drivers go fast, slow, fast, it's number one, getting the tyres back into a cool enough window that they might go again. And number two, they need to recharge the battery so they get full energy deployment on the next lap. Otherwise, they just wouldn't have any power on the straights to be competitive.
Perfectly explained, Jolyon Palmer. Thank you. And we'll be back with more explanation-based podcasting after messages about goods and services that you can spend your money on.
Screenings have audiences raving. F1 the movie is absolutely incredible.
Be ready.
Ready for what?
From the director of Top Gun Maverick.
I'm offering you a seat in Formula One, the absolute best in the world.
It's a fun, fast-paced thrill ride with a ton of heart.
You're crazy, bro.
And a reminder of why we love summer movies.
Anything else, Professor?
Drive fast.
I'll see you down the road.
Just keep watching.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Welcome back to F1 Explains. We are recording this a few weeks ago at the Monaco Grand Prix, so that's why you'll hear cars in the background, maybe the wind blowing in off the sea. I do like recording here. Ideally, I think I'd record all of my podcasts by the sea somewhere, I think.
There are worse places, aren't there?
Yeah.
it's very pleasant.
Yeah. It's very, very pleasant. And if you were listening before the break, you'll have heard us talking about team radios. We've got a few more questions on this. And this one is from Vince in Virginia, which is satisfying, isn't it, Vince in Virginia? Vince says, my question is about a team radio message I heard in a recent race. Carlos Sainz's engineer came on the radio and said, Albon, 21-8, 21-8. Carlos replied, OK, clearly it's a one-stop if Alex is doing 21-8. Can you explain what the numbers mean and why Carlos said what he said? We hear engineers and drivers pass around numbers a lot over their commentary, but there's no context for it, at least not for idiots like me. Vince, you're not an idiot. Now, we'd love to play you this team radio clip, but it's a bit unclear. So, yeah, it happened back in the, what did we say, in a recent race. I can't remember which one.
It'd be Imola.
Imola, there we go. Jolyon, can you explain that for us? Because those numbers just sounded like an episode of Countdown to me.
Well, that was Imola, where Sainz pitted. They were running together, the two Williams. Sainz pitted onto what was definitely a two-stopper. He pitted too early. Albon was left out. So Sainz is then doing his race. He's somewhere in the mid-pack trying to get back through on the fresh tyres. Meanwhile, you've got Albon out front ticking along. So when you're Sainz, you're hoping that your strategy is obviously the right one. So you're hoping that Albon's going to be going slower and slower, degrading his tyres, and actually that means that it's going to be more towards the two-stop. What he doesn't want to hear is Albon still going quickly up in fourth place, fifth place, wherever he was, because that means, you're actually probably not on the great strategy. Mm. So it's a lap time, a 21.8. It's a 1 minute 21.8. And that is what Albon's doing. Sainz will know what he's doing in terms of pace. And he's thinking, Albon is still ticking along really well at this stage. This is much later when he should be losing grip on the tyres that he started on. So he's thinking, this is not very good for me if Albon on used tyres is still doing that pace.
He's going quicker than me, and it sounds like he's on a better strategy than me.
Yeah.
This
oh, dear, this,
good.
This race is passing me by.
This might not be a classic. To me, it summarises the superhuman nature of Formula One drivers, because Vince is right. That's not obvious to the sort of naked eye or naked ear on this occasion. What's a 21-8 is. And we often hear plan B, plan C. Jakesy, they are concentrating on so many things other than just driving the racing car, and that bit alone is famously difficult.
Yeah, the extra capacity these drivers have, it marks out the great drivers that they can consider more than just turning the car at speed around the turns. And yeah, it's an interesting point about the, you know, the 21.8. You'd never mention the minute because there's always going to be a 1 minute lap.
Yes.
So because that never changes, that's why they go to the...
Unless it's raining heavily at Spa.
Yeah, well, exactly.
They have had the Bahrain short track, didn't they, where it was like a 54 or something.
Yes.
But then you don't need to say 54
yeah.
or 1 minute. You're never going to be defining things by the minute
so, yes,
in Formula 1, are you?
That was a very rare example where post-COVID, Formula 1 was getting in as many races as it possibly could, and we raced around a shorter specification of the Bahrain International Circuit and called it the Sakhir Grand Prix. And that was, yeah, one of the very rare occasions where we were having 58, 59 second lap times. And then I can pretty much only think of, yes, a very wet lap in Belgium that would go into the 2 minutes. Am I? That's, yeah. So you are normally 1 minute.
You're in the 1 minute territory. Nearly
yeah.
everywhere.
And it doesn't even matter if you're in the two or the zero because everyone's within the same minute. So you know the calibration. But these things are also... This is actually not even the complex bit for the drivers. This is like bread and butter, lap times. This is what they search for from the first moment of practice to the end of the race. If you're on your own and you're not making an overtake, it's just churning out lap times. So back to this example, if Sainz is on a 21.5, 21.4, he's looking at that every single lap to see what he's doing. Can he catch the car ahead? Is he feeling the lack of grip and the lap time's going away? It's just Formula One is governed by lap time. So it's what everyone's just dialed into.
And Jolyon, what age were you when you first got into a go-kart as a kid?
13.
Wow.
A little bit late. You were probably in before me.
I actually was, Jolyon. Yeah, wow. Okay, yeah. Anyway, 13 is still young.
So let me ask you the questions.
Well, that's not being anywhere near effective yeah. podcast, unfortunately. the bad thing is you could do this job and I couldn't do yours. But anyway, the fact is you guys have been also dialed into data since you were kids as well. That's another thing that Formula One racing drivers have been racing since teenage years, have been stepping into cars earlier than Jolyon at 8, 9. Jolyon, you mentioned when you moved into the commentary box, that wasn't too much of a challenge because analysing and crunching data and numbers and graphs, that is, you know, you're into that from a very young age, aren't you?
Yeah, and I enjoy it as well. It's part of like the puzzle of a driver. Yeah, you go out on track and you give it the big one and hope that you're quick. But if you're not, you need to, it's like working out a Sudoku when you come back, looking at all these things and trying to fix the missing pieces. And you work out, number one, where are you losing time compared to your teammate? It's all in the squiggly lines. Number two, can you do anything about it? And it's, you know, it's the challenge. And even the most talented drivers in the world are looking at it. Maybe Max less so at the moment because he hasn't got a good set of rival data to look at. But everyone's looking at the data. You look at it in 1 second and you can see what's going on.
Thank you for mentioning my brief racing career, which highlighted by racing against F1 TV's Alex Brundle.
Wow.
Wilton Mill, circa 2003, 2004.
He
very consistently beat me.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's a shame. I was really hoping that answer was going to be different because he'd have never heard the end of it.
There was one incident, which
here
I've talked about on a podcast before, where Alex tried to go optimistically around the outside of me.
Yeah.
I didn't leave him the room.
Wow.
Alex ended Alex's race. He ended up in the wall. And we got called to the clerk of the course's office.
Wow.
For those new to the lower forms of motorsport, that's effectively like being called into the FIA. And Alex Brundle turned around and went, I was preparing myself for a telling off. And Alex turned around and went, no, that was never going to work. It was over-optimistic for me. I'd have done exactly what he did.
Wow.
Wow.
And I
pragmatic
thought,
Brundle.
Are you sure it was Alex Brundle?
It was definitely Alex Brundle.
That doesn't sound like Brundle.
No, it was. And I was like, what a nice man. And it's a good job he did that because years later we now work together and it'd be awkward if not. I'd hate him. Anyway, moving swiftly
He's
on.
He's not a man to hold grudges either, so that's all good.
Moving very swiftly on to the topic of wet race starts. Clara is in Germany. Clara says, Dear F1 Explains, during a recent wet race, I noticed the tents all the teams build on the starting grid. Again, this is proper motorsport, isn't it? Tents on the grid. I know they are to keep the car from standing in the rain, but why is it important? I also wondered, isn't the start more difficult if there's a dry patch where they start and then a change of grip where the track gets wet? Or is the difference not that big? Thank you for bringing all the information from insiders to us fans. You guys are doing an amazing job. Well, that's nice, Clara. Thank you. Jolyon, that's a great point. Is that tent that gives you a dry patch a bad thing?
No, you would want the dry patch. So this is the initial part of a launch. You get more grip on a dry bit of circuit. So you take that and then deal with the consequences after it.
And just to be completely clear, that dry patch doesn't have that much of a dramatic difference. I mean, if it was particularly wet, it would go anyway, wouldn't it? But a little bit of a change of grip like that, where it's so short on a wet tyre, would you notice that in the car?
Literally, in the initial launch, maybe you would get a slightly better bite, but then it's all about feeding in the throttle. And it's in a very wet race, the start is not decided in the opening metre off the line. It's decided probably about 50 metres after that, where you're trying to feed in the throttle and get the second phase, they call it, where you're releasing the clutch and trying to avoid wheel spin. And also, it's pretty rare that the track is actually dry, because normally it's been raining for a lot of the morning. The teams only put the gazebos up when the cars are on the track, so they're probably mostly covering an already wet track unless it's dry and rains on the grid.
Alex, I always enjoy when Formula One, the most technologically advanced sport in the world, gets very basic, and all of a sudden we're sticking up awnings on the grid to keep us dry. You know, it sort of reminds us that this is connected to the grassroots motorsport at, you know, Snetterton, to name a UK racing circuit on a Saturday. It all feels a bit more basic motorsport when that happens, doesn't it?
I always think it looks like a farmer's market.
It does, when you might buy a nice cheese.
Nice cheese down at Ferrari, you know. nice bit of meat for the Sunday roast at the back of the grid.
That's, get their stalls out.
Yeah.
I'm imagining that if there were a team to offer a nice cheese, it might be Sauber, a Swiss cheese, possibly. Yeah.
That makes sense.
Who would do a chutney, do we think?
I think Aston Martin would love a chutney.
Yeah, I can see that.
They've got chutney written all over them.
Lawrence Stroll looks like a man who's eaten some chutney in his time. Anyway, while we're on a lighter note, I'm very much off topic. Caroline in Sweden.
Did that not explain things? You wanted to talk about farmers markets.
Listen, I'll do a podcast explaining farmers market. When you get to my time of life, that's a nice weekend out. Well, just before we move on, obviously as well, Alex, it's a practical thing as well. It helps not get the car wet and the people working under it wet.
Yeah, got to keep the car dry. You don't want the water. And if a start has been postponed, it's a serious amount of water that's coming down, and you don't want it in the electronics, because that could mean game over.
And imagine, you know, that everyone's plugging into the car as well. You've got looms everywhere, electrical wires. You've got laptops out trying to work on what's going on. So it's a practical thing. The cars often get quite wet when they're sent around the cars, but they're moving at speed and it's not too bad. But just getting a soaking on the grid helps no one.
F1 explains at F1.com. If you've ever seen anything Formula One related at a farmer's market or a country show, I'd also accept.
I want to see that grid walk at some point. No, oh, car. Where are the cars? Ah, oh, but there's some nice cheeses.
Some lovely cheese. You'd have some nice bread, wouldn't you?
Yeah,
you would. Some of that posh pasta you see for
Ferrari. Sourdough Central.
Yes. Sourdough Central.
You're keeping all of this in, whether you like it or not.
It's staying in. Sourdough Central is going to be a new spin-off podcast coming soon. Formula One drivers review bread. Finally, Caroline in Sweden says, "Hello, everyone. I really enjoy the F1 Explains podcast. It's one of my favourites." Thank you, Caroline. She says, "I've noticed everyone says mega all the time in F1. What's that about? Jolene, is that a you word, mega?
I wouldn't say it is, actually.
I don't think that would be more on my radar than your radar, wouldn't it?
I would say yeah, but it's not very me. I would say it's like a George Russell, isn't it?
He's a very George Russell. Mega.
Mega.
Yeah.
It's quite British mega. Yeah. Look, we've got a lot of American listeners on this podcast. F1 explains at F1.com. Do you use the word mega? I'm not sure.
I've not heard it.
There are
much.
Also words that like get in the public's brain. There's a summer where everything was awesome. There was a summer where everything was epic. I think mega. There was a year where everything was for sure. Do you remember that?
For sure.
Every single pen answer was, yeah, for sure.
Pace in the car, people have spotted on this podcast. We've had emails in saying all the drivers, every pen interview, say pace in the car. They've got a good pace in the car. Good pace in the car. Alex, Jakes, Jolie and Palmer, this has been lovely. I really appreciate your time. Thank you very much for joining us for some quick fire questions. Very much enjoyed your company.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having us.
You can catch these guys' commentary on the race highlights on F1's YouTube channel. And if you get F1 TV where you live, you can watch the races in full. Plus, Palmer's analysis is presented by Jolien Palmer. Why should people watch you analyse things, Jolien?
Because it's the deep dive after the Grand Prix, and hopefully exciting things happen in the Grand Prix that people want to see a little bit more of.
Look, that's on F1 TV. You can watch that all over the world. And you can also hear them both on the F1 Nation podcast. And Jolien has even had the honour of doing the hat-trick of official F1 podcasts by being interviewed by Tom Clarkson for Beyond the Grid.
Oh, it's a very good episode, that one.
Can't be many people who've done the hat-trick of all three. Is that should be up.
The Grand Chelem, they call it. The Grand Chelem of podcasts.
Yeah.
Can we have a leaderboard for that?
I think you're the first and only one. It can't be many.
It's
can
the
it?
Yeah. It's the
who else would be there? Mika?
Mick. I don't know if Mika's done an F1 Nation.
Oh, this he might have been
well, we're in Monaco.
No?
People talk about the Indy 500, the Monaco Grand Prix.
Yeah.
And the Le Mans 24
Hour.
Triple crown of F1 podcast.
I think we'll go with the triple crown of podcasts.
That's a producer Chris question this, isn't it? This producer
and
Jamie.
Now everyone's going to want to be on it, guys.
Yeah.
Everyone's going to want their chance.
Anyway, we do have...
Not the triple crown you were dreaming of when you started
I'll
your career.
I'll take it.
Listen, you take it. F1 Explains has new episodes every Friday.
Actually, it is. If I can do a couple of years with Renault, maybe I can get the triple crown of F1 podcast afterwards.
F1 Explains has new episodes every Friday. They're not all this chaotic, but I enjoy the ones that are. And you can send your questions to F1explains@F1.com and we'll try and answer them. And also at some point talk about chutneys and cheeses. Right, we're going to go now. That's it from us. Back next week. Bye for now.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You can't rely on blind faith to get the pregnancy support you deserve. Ritual's Essential Prenatal Multivitamin is the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Get 25% off when you visit ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Did you know that many products for pregnant women do not have their own clinical trials for safety or efficacy? That's because pregnant women are often excluded from clinical studies. Ritual is aiming to set a new standard with their Essential Prenatal Multivitamin. It's the number one best-selling prenatal and the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Moms taking Essential Prenatal had a lower overall cortisol level during pregnancy than those taking a leading prenatal. Plus, it's designed to be gentle on the stomach. Ritual doesn't just have your back. They have the receipts. Get 25% off at ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.